Hello and welcome to Let's Pod This. My name is Andy Moore. We're back again here in the Democracy Den, and I'm joined again by our good friend, Dr. Keith Gaddy. Hello, Keith. Welcome back to the show.
Andy, it's good to be here.
I like this as a recurring thing.
Yeah.
I like recurring guests.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of the 538 Politics Podcast, or what used to be the 538 Politics Podcast, but I always appreciate, there's certain guests. They had Claire Malone, who's at the New Yorker now. It's one of my favorite podcast guests, very insightful.
Yeah.
You're like an Oklahoma Claire Malone. That's what I'm saying.
I appreciate that. It's Nate's dad is a friend of mine, Brian Silver.
Really?
Yeah. He was a political science professor at Michigan State and really, really good guy, really good scholar.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So Brian taught Nate how to do multiple regression when he was 9 years old for a science fair project.
This explains
everything. Explains everything.
I would love, there's not enough audience here, I don't think, but I would love for like Galen Druk, who's the host of that show. He's his own podcast now called the GD Politics Podcast. But if Galen and Nate and Claire, they just did a live show, or they're about to do another live show in New York. And I was like, man, I would almost fly up there just to go to that event.
Yeah.
And my wife would not at all understand or justify the cost. Keith, over the last couple of episodes that you've been on, we've looked at, how the game is rigged with gerrymandering. And then last time we talked a lot about how the old New Deal coalition fell apart. And I think today we're going to ask a tougher question. And that is, like, has American politics moved from hope to grievance? And can we ever get hope back? I know it's a big question, and I know we were texting this week. Ezra Klein recently on his show, he had an interview with Ben Shapiro, a conservative.
Right.
I mean, they're two sides of the same coin, right? Like, they're very similar in style and background, and they talked a lot about grievance politics. And it was admittedly a bit of a new term for me. I thought I had a grasp for what it was just based on the title, but I think there's a lot deeper, and I think some really important implications, right, for like where we are today. And so, the last time you pushed me with a tough question about what does a winning liberalism, right, like this is the classical liberalism, not necessarily leftism, but and so I think today I want to kind of flip that and ask, is hope even viable anymore? I know, we talked about collective goods and shared prosperity. Maybe let's start though, by describing what grievance politics actually is.
Well, grievance politics, sort of evolves out of aspects of our reconciliation of how to make the American ideal real for everybody, right? How do you make the promises of the Declaration and the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, habeas corpus, how do you make all of this real for everybody?
For everybody.
Everybody. For everybody, irrespective of race, creed, color, or national origin, right? So, and various other identities, okay? It's real for everybody. And part of that goal is to knock down the systematic and explicit barriers, right? And that's what happened with the knockdown of Jim Crow in the South, for example, and the knockdown of Jim Crow in America, because Jim Crow was not just a Southern institution, it was a national institution. Ask any First Nation member, and they will explain to you how Jim Crow existed in the West.
Sure.
Right? Ask anybody of Chinese extract or Japanese extract in California. They will explain to you how Jim Crow was a national institution. And in knocking down those barriers, the question comes up, well, okay, you knock down barriers, but you've also done damage to a community. How do you create a fair playing field going forward? Simply knocking down the barrier is not enough. What are your remedies, right? Remediation. And this is where grievance starts in two directions. One is that people will come and say, I have been discriminated against. My forebears have been discriminated against. This requires restitution or remediation. It requires a remedy. And now we're in the business of either transferring effort or wealth or opportunity through preference to people based upon identity and experience, right? For those that are not enjoying that advantage anymore, they see that as something taken away from them.
Mm.
And that creates their grievance, okay? So you have the perception of grievance arising from historic discrimination on the one hand, and then you have the response that I, who did nothing to discriminate, am being called upon to subsidize someone based upon past discrimination. And this is where it all falls apart, Andy.
Let's make this tangible with a specific example that I can think of, and that's affirmative action as it relates to college admissions.
Yes.
Right? So, let me explain it, and then tell me if I'm wrong on understanding this. But, you know, historically, right? So we'll say in the Black community at large, like, did not have the same access to attending elite institutions, right?
Right.
Cost being a huge thing. It's prohibitive for lots of people.
Yes.
And some of the, you know, wealth inequality was built on a history of, you know, of segregation and slavery and all this stuff, right? So at some point in the 80s or 90s, there was this move towards affirmative action saying, well, we're going to secure some spots for Black Americans who are applying to college to ensure that we can help give them more opportunities because they were not afforded them in the past, and we're trying to, like, make up for that. And so their grievance was, hey, we've been left out. We should be able to come to college. And then in response, white students who felt like they were not allowed to attend because their spot was taken up by somebody else, now they have a grievance saying, well, this is not fair to me now, even though I didn't do anything to them back then. Is that a good example or bad
example? Yeah, it is. And in terms of time, it really starts in the 1960s, goes into the 1970s.
Okay.
And part of what happens is affirmative action has always been on tenuous legal ground because the decision that affirmed it was basically what we would call a 414 decision, right? I know this sounds like a defensive formation, but this is the Supreme Court didn't knock down affirmative action in the late 70s. They did not uphold it per se. They gave it a conditional approval. And ever since then, it's been litigation pushing back and pushing back. And the complaint that was brought at the time was that a white individual who met all the admission standards of somebody who was not white, who had been given a preference to get into, I think it was law school at University of California, I'd have to go back and check, that they were pushing back against affirmative action because they should have been admitted. Their slot was taken, right? And you look at some of the rhetoric that goes around regarding affirmative action, the most objectionable will say things like, quote, MySpace, end quote, was taken, close quote, by a Black woman, close quote. I put all those quotes in so that we are not taken out of context, okay? Because I'm not saying that.
Right, right.
Okay? And we're in an environment now where I have got to put all sorts of markers inside any effort to create a hypothetical. But that is the example. That is the example. And one of the challenges when we talk about affirmative action and we talk about remedies of this sort is, are they really identity group remedies or should they be economic remedies, right? Should this be a remedy to allow the working class to aspire, to allow a student who went to a bad school, irrespective of race, creed, color, or national origin, to have the opportunity to perform in that entry level at a better institution? You know, there have been different efforts to try and make this happen. So in the state of Texas, one thing they do is the admission standard to get into University of Texas and Texas A&M, they used to have a thing called the 10% rule, which is now the 5% rule, that at your high school, if you're in the top 5% of your class, you're guaranteed admission to UT or to Texas A&M. You can get into the two flagships. And when I was at University of Oklahoma and at TCU, we call ourselves the 6% institution. For those kids that can't make the top 5%, we go get them. But if you look at University of Texas in particular, it has this incredibly diverse student body. Just by virtue of having this 5% rule, they get the very best kids across the board, irrespective of national origin, across the state of Texas.
Just based on academics.
Just based on academics. And it also sometimes leads to some strategic enrollment choices by people, which is they'll enroll a very bright child in a substandard school system because they know that they'll get into the 5% out of there. So there's some gamification that goes on too.
By the parents.
By the parents, yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I went to high school just north of Austin, and I remember the 10% rule at the time, and I chose to come to college in Oklahoma. And I remember thinking, this feels like a foolish decision when I can go to school for automatically. I mean, I could get enrolled at UT just down the road. And a number of friends that did that. And I've always wondered, like, what the long-term implications were for the university. Right. Presumably, good students in high school are going to be good students in college, are going to be high, successful, high earners, which might be donors back to the university. So there's like a self, not self-serving, I guess a little self-serving, but like there's a incentive for the university to also want to attract the best students just for their own bragging rights, if not their bottom line.
Yeah. And so, going back to the point at hand about grievance, in this particular area, part of where grievance came from is a perception among different publics of how much progress had been made. So by the early 1970s, when you survey Anglo-white Americans, Anglo-white Southerners, they will tell you that the things that need to be done to ensure racial equality and racial opportunity have been accomplished. We've made all the progress that we need to make, and we don't need to do anything else. We've gone far enough. But then if we survey other communities, the African-American community, the Hispanic community, they will point out that simply leveling the field and unlocking the door is not enough, and there's much more work to be done. And this points to a variety of differences that occur in America regarding different perceptions of the same thing. If you want to go into the religious framework, for example, you can have two very different evangelical theological perspectives that exist, one of which is deeply invested in the Ten Commandments and literalism and a particular form of Protestant traditionalism in North America, okay? And it's very Calvinist. Mm-hmm. And there is another version that's invested in social justice and the idea of good works, which predominates in the Roman Catholic Church and in the black churches. So you've got these cut points in American religion that are in part structured by different interpretations of theology, and they make their way into politics as well.
Mm.
And so we have a lot of different vehicles for difference that get activated when you, for example, make the decision to take prayer out of public schools, because the argument is, who's going to write the prayer, right? Who's going to write the prayer? Whose prayer are we going to use? I had a colleague once years ago who said once, you know, I've had several students ask, could we open class with a prayer? And he stood at the class, this is 35 years ago, and he said, yeah, of course we could do that. Muhammad, would you lead us in prayer? Because he was a guy that liked to stir the pot,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
And he had an amazing career.
Yeah.
But
the same principle here, right? When the legislature wants to approve religious the St. Isidore case, right? Approve public mm-hmm. funds for a private virtual charter school, and then the Satanists said, "Oh, great! Like we're going to start a school too," and just to like prove the point of like,
yes,
you're not really doing this about religious freedom. You're doing this about one religion in particular.
Yeah, and you think about it. This is where we enter into the activation of grievance, right? Which is there's a lot of eye poking that goes on.
Hmm.
I want to poke you in the eye with my rhetoric. I want to take your argument and your seemingly neutral approach to this thing, which isn't, turn it on its head and throw it in your face.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of sitting down and saying, let us all come together and reason. And that gets back to the issue of hope, okay? Because part of hope is the ability to sit down and reason together towards the possibility of a new day. And for the National Democrats, of the last three presidents they have successfully elected, two took this approach of hope. That's Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. Each of them spoke in a rhetoric of hope, and it may not have been the same hope, but it was a related hope. And I think that we look at the predominant politics that exist in the major parties right now from their extremes. The edge on grievance and the edge on the need for restitution in all directions
mm-hmm.
is exhausting. And all it does is give weaponry to the other side to beat the other party about the shoulders and about the face.
Yeah. So grievance politics happens on both sides.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Do you feel like, I guess I have two questions. Mm-hmm. Who did it first, and then who does it better?
Okay. So the interesting thing about that is who did it first? probably Thomas Jefferson. Okay, if we're being honest. I mean, the nature of grievance and access goes all the way back to the framing and founding.
I was going to say, is the Declaration of Independence essentially is that a grievance document or a hope document?
It's both, because no thing is ever any one thing.
Right.
The Declaration of Independence, to a great extent, is an indictment of the king.
Right.
It reads like a bill of indictment.
Right.
Okay. But this weaponization of issue and this weaponization of compensation, if we're going to progress, the first thing we have to do is let go of who went first.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because you remember the other day we were talking about collective benefits, community benefits, and all that. The thing about game theory is that if everybody acts in their own self-interest without consideration of the collective interest, we usually end up in what's called a race to the bottom. We end up in a bad position, okay? Because to get in a better position, we have to cooperate. And a guy named Robert Axelrod at University of Michigan talked about this, and he said the solution to a prisoner's dilemma game where everybody's only acting in their own self-interest is at some point you have to signal that you're going to cooperate and then wait for the other guy to signal that he'll cooperate. And you may wait a couple of turns for that to happen, but when they signal they want to cooperate, you'll signal you'll cooperate too, and we end up in a better position.
Mm.
And the problem right now is that whenever someone has signaled cooperation, the other party has perceived weakness and jumped on them with a baseball bat.
Right.
And we do it in both directions. But the thing is, the right wing of American politics is actually better at this because they've got a more homogeneous community to draw from for grievance, which is among the working class white community in particular. We are now in decade six, nearly into decade seven, of hearing about white privilege,
mm-hmm.
and the need to engage in restitutive acts, right? That's a lifetime for a lot of these folks, for all of them. If you have been alive longer than that and were in the working class when it started, you're 80 right now.
Right.
And, you know, there's been tremendous progress. Yeah, there's more progress towards a colorblind society to come. I don't know if we want a colorblind society because a colorblind society whitewashes all other aspects of culture. It normalizes. And the thing is, we like our cultural and social distinctiveness. That's why the challenge is how do you respect that distinctiveness, incorporate it into a larger community, while also progressing towards the general good. Hmm. And that's where we get hung up.
So if the conservatives are better at grievance politics right now than the liberals, has grievance basically become the GOP's like brand now?
It is under the current regime. It's very much that brand. I mean, you know, the incumbent administration is really only about a voice of grievance, right? When you hear it, it's always about this negative thing about another group.
Mm-hmm.
And it is this voice of articulating how normal people are being shortchanged in this environment. It's an appeal to a very, very well-defined group that doesn't see itself as ever having enjoyed any particular social benefit or a level playing field by virtue of race or economic identity. They are in the group that systematically has suffered under the decline of the manufacturing economy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they used to be Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. They used to be Democrats. George Wallace was the first guy to show that you could reach out for what they called the hard hat vote back in 68 and 72. And be effective at peeling them off mm-hmm. from the Democratic mainstream. And if you look at the Wallace 72 campaign, it sounds a lot like Trump 16.
Hmm.
And the fact is, George Wallace might have won the Democratic nomination in 72 had he not been nearly killed by an assassin's bullet and ended up in a wheelchair. And then still stuck around politics for 10 more years,
yeah.
16 more years, right? He stuck around until 1986.
So it sounds like it is their brand, and they don't. It's a generational thing. They're grieving what they've lost, and they want to return to it, which is part of the whole "Make America Great Again" implication. is there any space for hope in that? Do they even need hope or vision to win?
Well, at some point in time, you need outcomes. At some point in time, you need outcomes. At some point in time, people have got to get exhausted with grievance all the time, because that's a hollow, dark place to live your life, right? It's a hollow, dark place to live your life, because you'll lose your soul if you're not careful. And now I'm projecting my beliefs.
Right.
But that's okay.
Yeah.
I get to be an individual now, and then I'm doing it right now. This I believe. But you also have to remember that grievance is also the brand of the left.
Mm-hmm.
It is absolutely the brand of the left, because it is about small group petition for an effort to get restitution, right? Or to get a regulatory regime to strip away what's perceived as historic disadvantage. And the fact that they can point to is discriminatory policies and discriminatory behaviors, both in the marketplace and by the state in the past. They can also point to the tenuousness of some of their rights and liberties under the law. And where this takes on stark contrast is in areas of sexual identity, gender identity. This is where same-sex marriage comes to the table, for example, which currently has a constitutional basis under a Supreme Court decision that's 10 years old now. And now we wait to see if it'll sustain itself. Mm-hmm. Those marriages cannot be invalidated, and they will not be invalidated, but having them in the future may be a challenge. And this is where the fear attaches on the left, is that there's the possibility of pushback coming from policies made by the right that's an effort to shove these folks out of the mainstream of American life in terms of the culture, in terms of the economy, in terms of the leading of a life in public. So everybody's got a grievance. Everybody has a fear. But as my colleague Jim Riddlesberger would say, as we do all this, was one child fed, was one child educated, was one job created? And the answer is no. But when Jim says that and I say that, we sound like a couple of New Dealers.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, it's probably what we are.
It strikes me that, you know, we talk about the left being big tent politics.
Yes.
And it sounds like if grievance is the brand of both mm-hmm. major parties, then on the right, it's like we have all shared, like we've all been harmed. We shared yes. this one grievance. And on the left, it's 100 smaller groups with their own grievance, which is why it makes it, we see like, you know, Dems in disarray or whatever the media likes to project there. Do you think that's a fair, it's like, if grievance is the same, it's just a different, how it's like enacted or how it happens on the sides are a little bit different?
Well, I don't know. Everybody has their style and they're entitled to their style, right? And that's politics. And the biggest problem with creating a coherent, attractive style and presentation is the fact that media are so fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
And we've never had more desperate need of editors for public life than we have right now, okay? We'll come to that. That'll be for a couple of months down the road, okay? Yeah. We'll get to everything that's wrong with the mass media. I think I'm going to step away from the word left and go back to liberalism.
Yeah.
And you and I have talked about these distinctions in the past. For American liberals, they've had the privilege in the Democratic Party in the last 35 years of not having one but two once-in-a-lifetime presidential candidates in terms of communication.
You're referring to Clinton and Obama?
Yes, absolutely. Two different versions of the same man, okay? These are men that were unlikely nominees. You weren't going to nominate a Southerner for president in 1992 until you did.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't going to nominate a black man for president in 2008 until you did. Both of them grew up in single-mother households, right? They grew up in the working class, okay? They grew up in small states out of the mainstream of American life, Arkansas and Hawaii. And somehow they got positioned based upon a combination of opportunity, talent, and political skill to become presidential nominees in their 40s. I mean, they are remarkable in that respect, right? They really are remarkable in that respect. I mean, Obama's 47, Bill Clinton is, 44 when he's nominated for president, mm-hmm. 45. And now the Democrats are in a, for lack of a better way to put it, there's a thing we talk about in higher ed. We're calling it, what do we call that? We've fallen off the ledge on enrollment, mm-hmm. and now we're in this gulf, mm-hmm. okay? The Democrats are in a bit of a national voice charisma gulf, in part because we're in the midst of a generation of political talent that predominantly went to the GOP across the nation. And the GOP became the dollar ambition party in much of the U.S., especially in the smaller states. So the Democrats have yet to find that singular voice. But we have to remember that Obama and Clinton both kind of emerged out of nowhere to become the nominees, mm-hmm. right? They weren't expected, yet there they were. And now the Democrats go looking for this. Donald Trump was an unexpected nominee. He was always in third place in everybody's radar screen headed into the first caucus in Iowa. And he consistently won with small margins in crowded fields to get the nomination. But the message he articulated was one that had been sitting there waiting for a Republican to pick it up. You know, this populist edge, this grievance edge. And no one in America is better at articulating a grievance than Donald Trump.
That is his brand.
He has a masterful charisma when it comes to that. And that's probably going to end up in a campaign ad, so that's okay. But a masterful charisma about that. And it's honed and polished by 40 years in the public eye.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it's been said that Donald Trump speaks and lives in the manner that a working class person thinks a billionaire speaks and lives, right? He talks like a guy from Queens. He's got garish and outlandish tastes, right? But it is like a cartoonish version of a billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
And it plays. It plays. It's professional wrestling as politics.
Mm. Right.
And Donald Trump has historic cultural ties to professional wrestling, so it's a completely fair comparison.
Man, Keith, I had never even thought about I'm seeing everything through this lens of like grievance versus hope. And professional wrestling is a grievance sport, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
The way that they create bad guys.
Yes.
And that they're always out with like a vengeance on someone. They're going to come out from the tunnel and like enact something. It is very much about grievance and fear and intimidation. No one is really rooting for like the good guy wrestlers, right? They exist, but it's not the same.
Yeah, well, it's heroes and heels.
Yeah.
And the best turn in the narrative in professional wrestling is when the hero turns heel.
Right.
Which is what happened with Macho Man Randy Savage did this. Hulk Hogan did this. I'm showing all my Gen X cred right now. Okay. I mean, I've met Jimmy Hart and Jerry Lawler and all these guys. My dad and I used to go to wrestling matches to watch the crowd.
Yeah.
We go to watch the crowd, which was epic.
Yeah.
It's like going to a drag race or a dirt track car race or a cockfight. Mm-hmm. Okay. It's just there's a particular quality to that audience that is sort of like a bloodlust.
Mm-hmm.
And it plays for grievance also. And so you create really interesting villains. And our villains in the 1940s and 50s were Nazis. And then they became communists, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we got the Iron Sheik, who was an Iranian villain.
Right.
And you know, you keep crafting these villains because it's an easy narrative to capture the basic mind, right?
Yeah.
It's guttural, it's primal, and it speaks to attitudes, right?
Yeah.
And it works in politics, and it works, and it's a perfect marriage with populism and populist issues, because populism is not a good word, okay? Populism is entirely about grievance. It's about grievance against elites, against expertise, against large sophisticated organizations like corporations, and the idea that a wrecking ball and a hammer and the wisdom of the masses and the layperson can make better decisions until you break the machine that you need.
Right.
Yeah. And we're in the midst of watching machine breaking by populism of the American state right now.
Well, and I'm thinking about even the founding of Oklahoma. If you read the state constitution, there's a lot of grievance about anti-corporations and about distrust in politicians. And so the reason we have things like the flashpoint of kerosene in our state constitution is because someone out there is trying to swindle me on kerosene and give me something that's watered down. And so it was governing from this same kind of like grievance base point.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, the thing about a grievance we have to remember is that grievances are formulated in contrast to what's viewed as fair play. Okay. All this fits the notion of fair play, which is if I show up sincerely with my dollar seeking an opportunity to buy something in the marketplace or to do something, I should have the opportunity to receive it and I shouldn't get swindled. Mm. And all of these grievances we've talked about, irrespective of race or gender or identity, fit that space, that notion that we don't want to get screwed. And everybody feels like they're getting screwed right now.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, we have the billionaire victim in American politics right now. God forbid I should have to pay some taxes
right.
in this nation of temporarily embarrassed former millionaires,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So on some level, grievance is exhausting, right, mm-hmm. to people around. Like, no one likes being around someone who is perpetually aggrieved. And if, you know, if Clinton and Obama sold us on hope and Trump sold us on grievance, which one of those actually has a future? Do you think, like, is there some point that we can anticipate, not that you have a crystal ball, but is there mm-hmm. some point that we can anticipate that Americans might say, enough, like, we're tired of mm-hmm. this. We want a vision for the future that is aspirational and not yeah. just aggrieved.
You know, this is where, and this one's for a different audience, but this I also believe, Christ did a pretty good job of this amidst the Roman Empire all the way to the cross. And it took 300 years to take inside the Roman Empire, right? And then it endured for two millennia. So it's permissible to have a message of hope and have it stick, in part because that message of hope is meant to sustain you through difficult times, right? There's an old saying from William Butler Yeats, the Irish playwright, who observed that being Irish, he had an abiding sense of tragedy which sustained him through moments of joy, okay? That's all a question of how you baseline, right?
Right.
But part of the challenge with grievance right now is everybody's looking for government either, not everybody, many people are looking for government to either engage in guarantees for them or effect transfers to bring back advantage and opportunity to them, or they're looking for government to punish people they don't like, and often both at the same time mm-hmm. from both directions. I think hope exists outside the state, the conceptual state,
right?
Right. And that you have to look beyond government, beyond the state for the sources of hope. And what the state should be doing is doing those things that are necessary to maintain that fair play that I mentioned earlier.
So if hope exists outside of the state, does that necessarily mean that it exists outside of politics as well? Like, I guess how enmeshed do we view government and the political machines?
Yeah. Well, I think there's room for hope in politics, and there's room for parties of hope. And again, if you want to go back in time, you look at the way Ronald Reagan pitched himself for re-election in 1984 with that masterful It's Morning in America commercial, mm-hmm. the most brilliant political commercial of all time. It is just fantastic, right? But that voice, that tenor, the facts that are pointed to, it just made you feel good.
Right.
And mind you, I voted for Mondale in 1984, okay? Yeah, I think I'm the only guy in my fraternity other than Chris Pinckney who was watching this who voted for Walter Mondale, okay? Because we both work for the legislature, which was Democratic. But yeah, you know, it's permissible to pitch that. Bill Clinton pitched it. Barack Obama pitched it.
The West Wing is based on.
Oh, the West Wing. You mean the government in exile during the Bush administration? Right. Yes.
You know, and even going back to 100 years ago, I think the quote is often attributed to Herbert Hoover, but I don't think he actually said it. But the phrase of a chicken in every pot.
Mm-hmm. A car in every garage, a chicken in every pot.
Right. I mean, that's essentially a message of hope mm-hmm. as a response to what could be a grievance, right? Like,
right.
And I would think about my grandfather, who was a career Air Force mm-hmm. Member. He was a firefighter in the Air Force, and they were stationed in England for a while in the late 50s. And they were pretty poor. I mean, they lived on right. base, and they had housing and stuff taken care of. But they and another American family pooled their money to buy one chicken
right.
for Christmas. So they couldn't go home. They couldn't afford to fly home to the States. And so they... And I remember my grandpa referring to that as like a chicken in every pot, but we only had one pot for two families. But he didn't say it out of anger.
Yeah.
He was like,
"Yeah,
we did this. It was a very hopeful moment, and we had a great Christmas with another family, even though we had meager means at the time. And I mean, my grandfather grew up as the son of a sharecropper in East Texas and, you know, lived in houses with dirt floors. And I think he was always grateful for any chicken he ever had. He, you know, thanked my grandma for every meal. And I've come to see his worldview as that was primarily hope-based and like gratitude-based. Now, late in life, as he became, you know, a fixture in front of cable news, I think that began to shift.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's alone in that. It sounds like that's that arc is pretty common across the American electorate.
Yeah, and this comes thing, if we go back to the marriage piece for a moment, we have to remember that marriage was intended to be a covenant, okay? Okay, so it is a sacrament of the church in the Christian tradition. It is a ritual in the Judeo-Christian tradition, but it is also in many ways a thing that is simply affirmed by two people and later recognized by the church and then also recognized by the state. And it's recognized by the state for legal reasons attending to property. Hmm. It helps determine heirship. That's why we validate marriage through a marriage license, is to recognize that the marriage exists. So in the event that one of the members of the marriage should pass or there's an effort to dissolve the marriage, we can recognize property and then come to a dissolution of the marital assets. Okay? But the concept of marriage itself is a sacrament or a covenant, right? So if you can take the state out of marriage as sacrament and covenant and you leave it to churches to decide, you leave it to people to decide, then separately you've got this licensure of a relationship that will govern the assets and the dissolution and the disposition of the assets should the marriage dissolve either due to death or divorce. You've put the state in its appropriate context because it's dealing with property and only property and obligation, for example, for the support of children. That's completely appropriate. The definition of marriage by gender is in part an effort to parameterize those property obligations. And people have been told, well, if you want to have gay marriage, why don't you just go ahead and you can just have a contract between the two of you.
Right.
The problem is we've defined certain social benefits in the context of marriage, such as Social Security benefits and survivor benefits. This is where the welfare state gets thorny, because the welfare state has set a preference based upon the historic norm. Nobody 90 years ago imagined gay marriage when they created Social Security, right? So we've got these thorny issues that relate to the welfare state that relate to the allocation of benefits that activate people's cultural preferences and their cultural prejudices. That's where the problem is in that space. So to the extent that we can disentangle the state from these other things, maybe we can move past grievance politics, right? Mm. But that requires some open-mindedness in the structuring of the wall between the state and the rest of society. Mm-hmm. Because instead we have this effort to almost resentfully impose the will of religion as culture, right? Or to resentfully impose the lack of religion as culture. And this is where everybody gets into dispute, because now we're dealing with something that we are simply not qualified to do, which is to prove God.
Right.
Yeah, you know, we can't do that. Okay. Right. You know, I mean, irrespective of how, I'm going to stop there because my example is going to be very, very disastrous.
We're going to get into Anselm's ontological argument for the existence of God, but
and Pascal's wager and how the Catholic Church picks saints. We're going to leave all that alone.
Yeah, that's probably smart.
Yes.
Well, then I see this effort for individuals or parties to say, hey, we've got a cultural set of ideas that we want to live by, and we want to ensure that those come with these protections for economic reasons, property, finances, you know, heredity, and then they seek to have the state validate that, right? And so there are things that I would argue are social customs. For example, having gender segregated bathrooms. There's no law that I'm aware of that requires men and women's restrooms. And in many places have unisex bathrooms.
Yes.
But I think there are people who would like it to be a law, even though that is a social norm that, like, we should be able to sort out among ourselves. We could redesign bathrooms to just have stalls and no urinals. It's weird that we're, like, culturally tied to disgusting urinals in some way.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny because I've been dealing with this particular issue for 10 years, both at the university and then just in conversation. Gender and bathrooms is an engineering problem. And there's an engineering solution. And it's a really simple, and you see it increasingly around the U.S.
Yeah.
And you see it in school design. You see it in residential hall design. You even see it in social space design, which is you've got a public sink behind a wall, and then you've got some stalls back there, and everybody's got privacy.
With full doors.
With full doors. And we actually ran into this in dormitory design at OU because we were looking at we had concerns among the gender fluid population regarding bathroom access and identity. We had concerns in the legislature regarding gender separation. So we were putting up two res halls that became the residential colleges. We designed the bathroom so that every lavatory was a single stall with a floor-to-ceiling door that locked. Every shower was a dressing room with a shower behind it with a floor-to-ceiling door that locked. And then there were a set of public sinks.
Yeah.
So if students wanted to have be on a gender mixed floor, we could have a bathroom for males, a bathroom for females like this. If we ever decided to go gender neutral, we were set up to do it in an engineering fashion without having to change anything. And it was an engineering solution. And what's funny is the issue just went away. Everybody was happy with it. I've never heard anybody complain. Right. I've probably ruined it now. I'm sorry, Joe Harrows. But, you know, there are good solutions to this that are actually economical.
Well, I went to a conference several years ago in some big city. I don't remember where it was, probably D.C. or somewhere like that. And it was a new conference facility, a new conference center and hotel and all that. And they just had bathrooms. And some people were like, which one do I go in? And they're like, just whichever one you want.
Yeah.
And the moment they walked through the door, they felt better because you'd walk in and there are people, men, women, whoever, like washing their hands. And then just like a wall of stalls. And it was the first day you could see people being a little nervous. Mm-hmm. And then by the second day, everyone was just like, I'm going to go to the bathroom. I want everyone to leave me alone, honestly. I don't care what gender you are. I'm here to use the bathroom and leave.
And the thing is, and this is where the engineering trick is very important. You design these spaces in a manner that they're not dark and dirty and secretive.
Right.
Because everybody's fear in this issue, everybody's fear in this problem, is the notion of violence and victimization in a space that you cannot escape from where there are no eyeballs and you can't have privacy.
Right.
And that's because we engineered these places in a particular way for the better part of a century. This approach creates a security that everyone's looking for.
Yeah.
And so it's a workable solution, and I think the marketplace is working it out. I think the construction industry is working it out. Architects understand this, and they'll work around it because they want to sell designs.
Right.
Yeah. So there's a market solution to this, and it's taking effect. And the only problem with presenting that solution is people will look to stress test it increasingly deeper and deeper because if you fix the problem, they lose their issue.
Mm. They lose their grievance.
They lose their grievance, right? And you've healed somebody, and oh, dear Lord, we can't do that, can we?
Listen, I, for one, welcome a world where urinals don't exist. I think they're gross.
Yeah, no, I'd agree. And I still remember in high school, at my high school, what they would do when they'd have women's basketball in our gym because the gym locker rooms were designed for men, what they would do is they would put plants in the urinals as planters. So there may be a future for urinals in this respect,
there you go.
Okay, which is you can just turn them into self-watering planters or something.
Nice. But cleans the air too.
Hydroponic planters. Yeah. I don't know.
That's funny.
But yeah, it's you save money. And my dad was a master plumber, so I grew up on this stuff. With the advent of the low-flow flush, any efficiency you ever have with a urinal has gone away.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, now we've gone far afield, but let's bring it back to liberals and conservatives in this kind of grievance culture. It strikes me that if liberals keep narrowing their tent to all these micro grievances, that conservatives really never have to change, right? It is much easier to run a platform of, you know, one big grievance or a few big grievances that are shared,
right,
then try to organize a myriad of people with 100 micro grievances.
Yeah, and part of what you do is you open the door to start picking off constituencies.
And it's just going to fall apart, right? Right. There's like you fracture among all of those lines.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And anybody who pays any attention to politics, they know where the fractures and the lines and where the micro constituencies are. We don't need to elaborate those. Mm-hmm. But the conversation I've been having for the last several years with students, with the media, you and I have talked about this on the side, is that 1% problems don't win in politics unless it's about trying to get rid of taxes, which is the billionaire's issue, right? But dealing with issues that deal with these 1% micro constituencies are generally not winners for the vast middle. And at some point, the vast middle says, you know, they say, okay, well, what about kitchen table issues, right? What about the cost of fuel? What about the rising cost of housing? What about opportunity and access for my children to come in and aspire to a middle-income, middle-class style of living? Last time you and I got together, we talked about the costs of education and higher ed. We didn't address the idea of other forms of education, such as vocational and technical, which we have more need of, which can fuel well-paying jobs, mm-hmm, where it's highly variable from state to state how well we deal with it. But that dealing with those issues also requires rethinking the model in general. But if we're so busy hung up on 1% solutions, we can't systematically think about how do you move beyond the industrial high school.
Right.
Yeah. And the industrial high school has nothing to do with VOTEC. It's the idea that you've got a large structure with a set curriculum, with people coming in set periods, going through a curriculum in an approach. And education has been evolving away from the industrial model for 3 decades. That means we need to really rethink how we do things in that space. What we're not thinking about is the outcome, which is, are these kids truly prepared for what they're going to do either in VOTEC or do in college, right? So part of what we have to do is think engineering backward into what are those tools going to be? What are kids learning right now that I need them to know in 10 years when they walk into my classroom and they're 19 years old and a sophomore in college?
Right.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I don't think the liberals have time to reverse engineer an entirely new educational system.
No.
Is this, you know, there's the old adage that I'm sure we've referenced on the show before of Republicans fall in line and Democrats fall in love.
Yes.
And as I'm thinking about that phrase in terms of this like grievance versus hope, it strikes me that maybe part of what happens on the liberal side is that they are waiting for a once in a generation talent, mm-hmm, who can articulate a vision for hope,
yes,
that is grand enough that everyone is willing to set aside their personal grievances to collectively aspire to this big thing. And then on the conservative side, they just say like, hey, this is our grievance.
Yeah.
Everyone get on board with it and we're going to voice it collectively, which makes it sound very loud because it's so many people. And that, so they have fallen in line behind the prescribed grievances, mm-hmm, and the other side has like given up theirs. And right now, maybe because the last, you know, liberal president, Joe Biden, did not articulate particularly a vision for hope. It was a anti-grievance, right?
Like, yes.
And if there's a whole generation of voters,
yeah,
who have no idea what hopeful politics even looks like or sounds like. And so even if it emerged from the wilderness, it would be so foreign to them, they wouldn't know what to do with it.
Yeah. And here's the thing, where this comes into play, and this is what conservatives are good at. Conservatives have learned how to talk to the working class. And in activating the grievance, they've activated the notion of economic opportunity. Hmm. They've stolen the Democrats' working class economic message. Because the working class in the United States, there is a large segment that is in trades or they're in service industries more so than trades. And they need collective bargaining. They need organization. But what's happened is there's this vast swath of what we might call the skilled trade working class. And these are you guys down in Moore, Oklahoma, or over in Bethany, who have got the three-bedroom, two-car garage with 1.5 baths, and they've got the minivan that they bought or the crossover that they bought that mom drives, and then they've got the truck with the pipe racks with the logo on the side mm-hmm. that is their work vehicle. Mm-hmm. 40 years ago, these guys were working for a union contractor. Mm-hmm. Today, they are independent contractors. We are not seeing liberals and the left speak to them because the economic issue gets lost in the micro constituencies on the one hand. And then on the other hand, healthcare is esoteric, right? But they're not speaking to their as much as the left may address their issues, they're not articulating it. Mm-hmm. They don't articulate the argument to be with them. And what the right does well is articulates that because they don't speak about hope, but they speak about opportunity. And they engage that skilled tradesman as a small businessman, right? Mm-hmm. And one of our two U.S. senators in Oklahoma is a plumber, plumbing contractor. I mean, I get why he wins, and I get why he's effective. He's effective because, man, he hits that sweet spot in a really good way. Mark Wayne Mullen knows how to hit that sweet spot that resonates with most of the people in this state, overwhelming majority of people in this state, including a lot of Democrats. Mm-hmm. And you can't get past that.
Right.
That's what they do well, is you know how to hit that sweet spot with that critical constituency, which, to be honest, the Democratic Party ignored probably since about 1980, ever since Michael Moore brought it to our attention and Roger and me.
Right.
We've been doing this for a while, okay?
Well, and so the liberals' message of hope then has become, you can be like us, which necessarily creates an us versus them, like dyad between the haves and the have-nots.
Right.
And the conservative message, while perhaps of grievance, is a relatable message for more people, and they can see themselves in the story of like, well, this, and so it flips it because it is like, we have the same grievance. They made it out, right? Mark Wayne sold his plumbing business and is a millionaire. Mm-hmm. Like I can see myself doing that, even if it's not actually possible.
Yeah. And I'd say, so if liberals say, well, you can be like us, conservatives say you can be like you.
Yeah.
And I've always argued that conservatism is easy to sell because it doesn't ask of any change from a person who's already somewhat conservative. It asks you to do nothing except be yourself.
Mm. Which is ironic given the message on the left.
Except for the people on the left, which they want to have change or just go, let's be honest, they just want those people to go away because they're bothersome, right? Oh, you're bothersome people, please go away. Please go away. Don't show up. Don't bring us your 1% issue, right? And the thing is, you know, for a half century now, we've been opening the doors and opening the closet for people to step out. And you're not going to make women go back into the kitchen, gays go back into the closet, minorities go back to being out of the way and being invisible. People don't go away. So what you need is someone needs a politics that transcends those parts of identity and identifies the broad basis that can carry a lot of people forward together. And there has to be a sensibility about that. But it also means we have to put real limits on our expectations of the state, because if you affirm having a tremendously expansive state in one area that you like, that means you've also affirmed having a tremendously expansive state in areas that you don't like. You know, if the state can do this thing, because the state has got widespread power in the social arena, It can take steps in a variety of directions. You may not like some of those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, what essentially we're talking about through all this whole episode is the tone of politics, right? Is it a grievance tone or a hopeful tone? What do you think it would take to make hope viable again?
I mean, seriously, I think it, from my own perspective, it is about limiting the scope of power of the state.
Okay.
It's about what you do is you put the definition of marriage beyond the ken of the state. Okay?
Okay.
But if you wish to have your marriage, if you wish to have the benefit of, if you wish to have economic benefits, the transfer of wealth, things like this, we have to have a different vehicle that's separate from it. Okay.
So sort of like, so not a marriage, but like a personal contract of some kind, mm-hmm. something that is legally recognized.
Yeah, and the thing is this is, and then the other thing we have to do is we have to accept the fact that federalism is going to do what federalism does, which is you're going to have variability in a variety of areas that are beyond the scope of the national government so that you can have local cultures. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we're not going to like that local culture. Al Hirschman, in his 1970 book, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, talked about the three ways you can respond to government policy you don't approve of. One is that you can just leave. You can go somewhere else and get away from the policy. You can engage in protest against it, which is voice. Mm-hmm. Or you can just give in and be loyal to the state. Mm-hmm. But if you think about it, Americans, until recently, historically, about one-third of a population in any given urban area was born there and grew up there. Another third was born nearby, but then moved in there. They grew up elsewhere, they came there. And then another third was from way beyond, mm-hmm. okay? So we've consistently had two-thirds of the population being mobile, at least in their state, one-third of the population being nationally mobile. I mean, I'm living in my seventh state in my adult life mm-hmm. right now down in Texas. The problem is, do you have the ability to go? And if you want to talk about the limits of going and the possibilities that exist in going, I would tell everybody to go back and read Steinbeck.
Yeah.
Go back and read Grapes of Wrath. It's tough out there.
Yeah.
And sometimes you have to make the choice to go. And that's not meant to be, just grab your bootstraps, bucko, mm-hmm. and step up. But it means taking a realistic look at the ability to change your community and change your state. And ask the question, can I be who I want to be and have the life I want to have here, or is there a better opportunity somewhere else? And then you act on it.
You know, we talk about that a lot in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. right? I had a friend from another state this week ask, why do I still live here, mm-hmm. given some of the negative things about it? And I was like, my daughter has some, my youngest daughter has some special needs, and so mm-hmm. she could undoubtedly be better served by some of the resources available in other states. We don't leave because I have two other kids. I'm not going to leave them here when they live with their mom part of the time. And so there's external forces on my decision-making that I have to consider that mean not right now. And when my kids are older, well, now I've got, mm-hmm. Parents to consider or my in-laws to consider. And so there's lots of reasons that make exit not a viable option. And so you have people who feel stuck. Mm-hmm. But also, I mean, what you were saying about people, how many folks moved. I mean, we've, over the last 100 years, we've seen a continuous migration from rural areas to urban areas, which one might argue, maybe that's not the, I guess people are often pursuing economic benefit, not necessarily exiting because of some grievance with policy necessarily. But, but if they are choosing to move for whatever reason, then I think that diminishes exit as a viable remedy for political pressure.
Well, and it's you have to decide what your opportunity structure is going to be, and you act on it. So I'm gonna. It always comes back to political science when we get together,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So my for a number of years, I had a textbook with a co-author who had been a professor of mine at Florida State named Thomas Dye. And Tom is over 90 now, but Tom articulated decades ago a concept called competitive federalism or corporate federalism.
Okay.
And what he argued is that the reason you want to have cities and counties that have got limited autonomy and states that have got limited sovereignty in addition to a national government is it allows a county or a city to look around and decide what is the market basket of goods and services and policies they want to provide to the public and have them be attracted to it. So different states articulate different baskets of policies in terms of social benefit or economic regulation. Down in Texas, it is no income tax, right?
Right.
No income tax. That's the big thing down there. We will never have an income tax in Texas. In Florida, it was no inheritance tax for the very longest time. But you articulate this in order to attract the type of people you want to have come to their community. And then you can do things like compete to have the Walmart through structuring your local sales taxes. You can compete to have a major industrial factory come, like the Tesla factory outside of Austin, right? Mm-hmm. You can compete in this marketplace by creating an environment that will allow you to grow the kind of community you want to have and to grow the kind of people you want to have. And in Texas, you're able to have Austin, okay, and Houston and Laredo and Fort Worth and Plano and Frisco, right? You can have all these very different places in terms of what they provide locally under the same umbrella of state government and more broadly under national government. You have to have that latitude. Again, though, this is where you have to pay attention to the margins. What happens when that approach creates basically a drawbridge? And so one of our biggest problems in the United States right now is the ability of the working class to be able to afford to live near the places where their jobs are. It's a problem here in Oklahoma City. It's a problem we have down in Fort Worth. It's a problem pretty much everywhere that we don't have enough accessible quality housing for people. That ability to buy into the American dream and not be a renter is becoming more and more difficult. And even rents themselves are going, who was the guy that ran for mayor of New York a few years back, the rent's too damn high guy with white gloves?
Yeah,
the rent's too damn high everywhere in the U.S. right now. And so, but irrespective of having competitive federalism, this would probably still be the case. But competitive federalism allows for experimentation in public policy and to try and figure out what works, okay? And then we get evidence, and then that allows us to change the status quo elsewhere. I mean, we got same-sex marriage a decade ago, and lo and behold, the sky did not fall. The sky did not fall. So that seems to have been less of a disaster than critics would have led us to believe. By the same token, for some reason, concepts like charter schools have not been a complete disaster if you've got a good regulatory regime in place to engage in oversight. As long as government will put a regulatory regime in place and then engage in oversight, we have good enough environmental laws, for example, if we implement them, if we follow them. And those laws have got to have a combination of rigor and flexibility to be effective. And we don't want to turn that law into a bat that we beat everybody across the head with. And so part of it is having an effective and good faith administration and implementation of the law as articulated.
Well, it strikes me that a good economic policy platform is necessarily one of hope, right? Like you can have some grievance arguments around it. But, you know, last week on the show here, we had City Council member Kamal Pennington talking about the upcoming general obligation bond vote in Oklahoma City. Well, the municipal bond, just like the MAPS program, is a message of hope. Look at what we can achieve together when we pass this, right? It's a collective impact. It's a, it is a message of hope. And I think Mayor Holt, arguably, is as a politician who is led with a hopeful message. Like that's very much his brand, which is in stark contrast to, you know, other local politicians like Ryan Walters, who have very much embraced a grievance-based policy approach. And I, so it seems like hope is viable. And I think it's interesting that, if I'm right, this is my theory, but if if hope is, if economic policy is necessarily a hopeful element, then hitting people at the kitchen table issues, which are so often economic in nature, requires a cohesive, compelling, hopeful message.
Yes. And part of that means you have to be careful about how you frame your argument, and you have to pick good models that can be vehicles for hope. The reason MAPS has worked for three decades in Oklahoma City is it's a pay-as-you-go program, right? It's a sales services tax, basically. And anytime we do something, we've got the cash, right? It's a pay-as-you-go approach. Bonds are not pay-as-you-go, okay? Bonds are the acquisition of debt in the future. We can call them anything else, but that's why they're acquisition of debt for the future. And the last time I checked, no bank ever seized a road. Because you defaulted on your payments.
But they can charge higher borrowing costs.
Yes, they can. And this, the thing about pay-as-you-go, it's an inherently conservative, practical approach. Oklahomans will vote for taxation if they know where the money's going. Oklahomans will vote for public goods if they know they can be paid for in real time, right? So the MAPS model is a very attractive one. It's a variation of what's called a SPLOST, which is a Special Project Local Option Sales Tax. That's the national term for it. It's a SPLOST. And it works. And you can see the tangible benefits. And this city, in the three decades since I moved here, has shown the direct consequence of investing in collective and public goods. without accruing debt.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and besides, who can argue with a penny, right? Hey, it's only a penny. But I also look at the sales taxes in Oklahoma, and they're twice what I pay in Texas, mm-hmm. right? I look at the income tax in Oklahoma, and it's infinitely larger than what I pay in Texas because it exists.
Right, right.
But I also look at the property taxes, and they're 40% higher down there.
Right.
Yeah.
There's a trade-off, right?
Yeah, like, there are trade-offs, yeah.
There's no, it's not a zero-sum game. The money's got to come from somewhere.
No, and remember what Bill Archer, the old Republican congressman who was chair of Ways and Means, used to say, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax the guy behind the tree, right? Yeah, that's it, the easiest way to win is to ascertain who your opponents will be and make sure they have no political power to resist. The basis of environmental justice is in part the fact that pollution would fall upon communities that have no organizational ability or the ability to affect change or to petition. And that's why we get some of the environmental choices we make in terms of industry historically.
Yeah.
It's very, very easy to victimize people that don't have the ability to organize and have no voice. And that's not a partisan choice. That's just empirics.
Yeah.
That's what we do empirically, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is all very interesting. Well, Keith, thanks for coming in.
Pleasure,
again this
Andy.
Week. I look forward to the next conversation already. And I assume I will not be alone. I'm sure our listeners will be dwelling on this grievance versus hope message. Mm-hmm. And I think in there is, we each have a choice, right? Of what's the politics, what's the environment we want to foster.
Yes. And you asked me, how does hope come in? It starts with the simple assumption as political actors that we'll greet every person in front of this, of us, as someone who we should love and figure out how to work with.
Yeah.
Rather than somebody who is to be vanquished or destroyed.
Right.
Including our deepest enemies.
Yeah.
Coach Bowden down at Florida State used to say, if somebody hates you, be kind to them. It'll drive them nuts.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
So that's what you got to do. You just hope comes from the individual and from your heart.
Yeah. That's a good message to end on. It's a hard truth, but like it still feels good, right?
Exactly.
Great. Well, Dr. Keith Gaddy, thanks for being here as always. Listeners, thank you for being here as well. We talked about liberalism's uncomfortable truth about their slide into grievance, the conservatives' mastery of grievance politics, that big hope versus doom question, and the role that we can each play. Every day, every episode, we say decisions are made by those who show up. This is a decision you can make by how you show up. Are you a grievance-based person or a hope-based person? It's not a judgment. I'm just asking you to ask yourself. Keith, I think we've got some outlines for our next few episodes, at least. I'm sure we'll come up with more from there.
Yeah, we do. As we indicated when we started this, is an ongoing conversation, and it's a perspective.
Yeah.
Some of this is prescriptive, some of it is descriptive, but each of us has to choose how to lead our life. I think you have a choice. And you, when you make that choice, you make a choice that you can live with and grow out of. Either you've got a growth-based mindset or you don't.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. Thanks, Keith. Listeners, thank you. We'll see you next week.